All right, everyone. Well, we're very excited. It's about 2:35, so we're going to go ahead and get started with our final plenary panel. I know there's a lot of people finishing up their breakouts and coming in, so I do imagine it's going to fill in as we keep going. I'm Tyler Huebner again, Executive Director of Renew Wisconsin, and we're very excited about our final panel here today to close things up and really send us off thinking about how we can scale up to meet this challenge of the future. I want to thank again our summit partner sponsors who are supporting these panel sessions, and really excited about the diverse panel that we have here in front of us today. So a really great mix of perspectives to talk about the theme of our conference and how we're going to move forward together. And so from right to left here, I'll introduce them, and then I'm going to start with questions. So first we have Beth Soholt, who's the Executive Director of Clean Grid Alliance. Carrie Ann Renland, who is the General Counsel and Vice President of Madison Gas and Electric. Amy Hart, who's Policy Director of Sunrun, which is a rooftop solar company. And Ken Walls, Dr. Ken Walls with Madison College, who runs their renewable energy program. So we're very excited to have you all today. So just to kick things off, Beth, can you please give us an understanding of Clean Grid Alliance and what kind of projects and programs you're working on?
Sure, thank you, Tyler. Hopefully everybody can hear me all right. First of all, thank you for inviting me here today. Glad to participate in this great conference. Clean Grid Alliance was formerly known as Wind on the Wires. We just rebranded in September of 2018. And so, following the trends that are happening in the renewable industries, our members, our industry members, were working on more than wind, and so we needed to remove wind from our name. So we gave ourselves a little bit broader umbrella to work under with Clean Grid Alliance because our members are working on wind, solar, and storage. And we focus primarily on utility scale, but I will say there's an awful lot coming as far as aggregating distributed generation, aggregating DERs. FERC is likely to issue an order in the not too distant future about aggregated DERs. And then the wholesale market will have to figure out, and the states will have to figure out what they're going to do with that. So we really focus on state policy, on technical work. We do a lot of communications, but I think we're best known for our implementation. And so passing a bill at the legislature or having a company make a proclamation about a renewable energy goal, that's kind of step number one. Step number two is really, what does that mean from a practical standpoint? What are we going to put in the ground? What decisions are we going to make? And so we work a lot on those pieces. Do you want me to go on to a couple key initiatives?
That would be great.
Okay. So
it's too close.
One thing we're really focused on right now, there are a number of projects in the pipeline in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, as well as the other states we work in. We do have a 9-state footprint, and so there are a lot of moving pieces for our team at Clean Grid Alliance all the time. We have all our legislatures in session in our 9 states, lots of pieces there. But we're really focused on helping people get their projects in the ground, driving state policies forward. We do a lot of work with utility integrated resource plan, helping them think about what kind of mix they need to have to achieve carbon reduction goals or think about electrification. We do work on transmission expansion. It's kind of been our key area, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. But we're also looking at the market rules, the energy market rules in the Midwest for the grid operator, MISO, or the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. We have a lot of rules that were still created for old types of generation, and those are constantly needing reforming and reworking, and so we're looking at what needs to be done. We're participating in a lot of state regulatory dockets, and then I would just say, education and communication on something that happens behind the light switch is critical. The public needs to think more about the choices that we're making, how to help support clean energy, And so we try to connect the dots a lot for the public and whoever we're talking with.
Excellent. Next, Carrie Ann Renland is with Madison Gas and Electric Company, which is a utility and a community energy company. So Carrie Ann, why don't you tell us a little bit about MG&E and what are the key initiatives and opportunities you're seeing for scaling up renewables?
Okay. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here today. I would have liked to see a little bit more sun today.
We had it yesterday, and yes. Ken will talk about that with the ribbon cutting at MATC.
But I am Carrie Ann Renland. I'm Vice President and General Counsel at MG&E. And in that capacity, I have the opportunity to lead our legal department and risk management department, but also our environmental sustainability and safety area, as well as our government affairs area. And That's a very unique opportunity to be in a lot of this space. We have a very small service territory compared to other IOUs. We're an investor-owned utility here in Wisconsin, traded on NASDAQ, and we have about 151,000 electric customers and 158,000 gas customers. We've been around Madison. We like to say we've been here longer than the city itself, 150-plus years. We have about 700 employees. We are your community energy company. You can run into our CEO at Pick and Save or me at a local hockey rink, but we are very accessible people. And we take very seriously our obligation as a regulated utility to provide safe and reliable energy for all customers all the time. We're very good at it. We are consistently one of the best and most reliable utilities in the country, and we intend to do that throughout the scaling up. I did think it might be good for you to see just a flash, like a snapshot of our scaling up. Over the last decade, we have been able to go from about 11 megawatts of wind capacity to 153 megawatts. And that includes our Saratoga wind farm that it will go online just this month. And that is our largest wind farm to date, a 66 megawatt facility. And then on the solar side, we have a lot going on there as well. We have a shared solar, a community solar project available in Middleton. We are working on an expansion of that project right now at the Maury Airport. We also have pending this week, right now, two very large utility, for us, very large utility scale solar projects that would provide us another 100 megawatts of solar, and that's at Badger Hollow and Two Creeks. Depending on where, what part of Wisconsin you're from, I think it's Two Creeks. Right. And then we're working with Dane County to provide them a direct customer solar project through a renewable energy rider at the Dane County Regional Airport. So all of our visitors that come to town will see we'll see that as well as Ken's rooftop. So, but that's about. That's an up to 8 megawatt project. And I thought it'd be interesting for you to know we've got about 670 customer-owned DG interconnections right now. I was telling Sarah before the, or Amy before the panel that we were at ComEd a year ago or a year and a half ago, and we had like more than double the DG interconnections that ComEd had in their entire area.
And they serve like 5 million customers or something.
Yeah, all of Chicago. So it's just interesting. And then next, I thought I'd just be able to tell you how fast that has happened. We've nearly doubled the residential interconnection systems since 2016. And on the commercial capacity side, that's nearly quadrupled since 2016. So we are indeed scaling up.
Scaling up. Great. Next is Amy with Sunrun, and Sunrun is a distributed solar provider. And so again, this diverse set of opinions from large-scale renewables utility. Amy, why don't you tell us from the distributed solar and Sunrun's perspective, what are the key initiatives and opportunities you're seeing?
Sure, thanks, Tyler. So for those of you who don't know, I wanted to give a little background of where Sunrun is. I'm from Wisconsin. I'm a Wisconsinite. I live in Milwaukee, but I work for a national solar company. We just do residential solar. So we install and finance solar across the country in 23 states, and including DC and Puerto Rico. And we'll talk a little bit about probably Puerto Rico and our experiences on the storage side a little bit later on. But that's really interesting because it gives me an opportunity, and those of us on our policy team working with other installers and industry folks, to think about lessons learned from other states and where we're going as we think about what's needed in a transition. So when we're approaching looking at public policy, ranging from, you know, an RPS down to interconnection rules, it's always from a perspective of that customer first. So what do customers want? And having sort of a customer-centric approach to looking at our future energy needs and where that power can come from, how to create a more resilient grid. So some of the things that, even working with other installers and companies, specifically on the DG side, so rooftop solar behind the meter, what we need to prepare for that transition and to scale up is really consistency and stability. Those are the two things that I hear repeatedly in Wisconsin, but also in a lot of the other states that I work in. And that means stability in our foundational policies. Mm-hmm. So we see the numbers continue to grow in a variety of types of solar, but what does that, we have a long way to go. We're still at below 1% for behind the meter systems, for net metered systems and interconnected systems. That we have a long way in Wisconsin. And so let's keep these stable policies that have allowed businesses to start, that have allowed the market to grow, that have allowed customers to have that choice while we think about what comes next. That's something that a lot of other states have done, and it's allowed the market to grow as we think about it in the future. And then the other piece is that consistency between jurisdictions, whether it's cities, villages, and even between utilities. I think that's something that as we grow and we try to serve more customers and the interest is there, regardless of the size of the customer, that is really hampering, not even hampering, but just creating obstacles, a lot more time on the install side. So just at a glance, those are two things worth thinking about.
Super, and we're gonna dive into a lot of these issues. And so our final panelist, Ken Walls, Dr. Ken Walls from Madison College, who's educating this workforce of the future. Tell us about what are the key initiatives at Madison College and what are the key opportunities you see for scaling up renewable energy.
Yeah, thanks, Tyler. I had some rather dry opening information prepared to share, but after listening to the morning's panel, my students and I had a pretty energetic discussion, so I rewrote my remarks, and I just wanted to make 2 points before I tell you about the college. The commissioner this morning kept repeating 3 priorities for energy. It had to be safe, reliable, and affordable. My students would tell you that's wrong, and it reflects 19th century thinking. Yes, energy needs to be safe, it needs to be reliable, it needs to be affordable, but it also must be clean. And it's that fourth priority that unifies all customers, and it's why the overwhelming majority of citizens support renewable energy. And clean energy is not a political issue. Children that suffer from childhood asthma and air pollution have no party affiliation. Everyone who eats fish should be concerned about mercury pollution from coal-fired power plants. And global warming is going to affect flooding and crop failures in both Democratic and Republican districts. This is why environmental impact must be an equal consideration when we're looking at energy policy. I said I had 2 issues, so let me mention the other one.
But wait, there's more.
There was a gentleman on the panel this morning who said that we need to have coal for baseload energy. My students will also tell you that this is wrong. You can generate baseload energy from all kinds of sources, all of which are cleaner than coal. Furthermore, Germany has already shown the world that the concept of baseload energy is becoming irrelevant in the modern grid of the future. What you need is flexible, dispatchable generation, and coal doesn't do that. Hydropower does, biogas does, batteries can do that. That's where we should be investing in new technologies to build out a better grid, a modern grid, for our electric generation. So thinking about the college, what we need is we need visionary leaders with a forward-thinking perspective to devise policies and move the market forward that help electric service providers like MG&E, like Xcel, to transition to clean energy sources. So we're committed to educating the next generation of people to help lead that charge. So let me just share a little bit about what the college is doing. So to that end, we launched in 2005 a renewable energy certificate. We currently have about 50 students enrolled, and I'm happy to say that last year was the first year that we had waiting lists for all our courses, and we had to over-enroll and exceed our enrollment caps. Our school was an early signatory to the American Colleges and Universities Climate Commitment, and over the past decade, I can say that we reduced the energy consumption of our buildings by 60%. Last year, thanks to the leadership of our Student Senate President, who is here today, Stephen Ansorge, the college completed a solar roadmap where we looked at all of our campuses and all of our buildings and put together a plan prioritizing our investments in solar for all of those facilities based on both economic, environmental, and educational opportunities to our students. Can you click ahead one slide, Tyler? Yesterday, we were fortunate enough to commission the largest rooftop solar system in Wisconsin. For those of you that were there, we even arranged to have the sun come out to commission that. It was a beautiful day to flip the switches on the inverters and power up that system. Kind of an amazing thing. We did test it a little bit before we turned it on yesterday. We slowly brought on pieces of it over the last week to make sure that the communications were working and that the rapid shutdown protocols were meeting expectations. Just over the last 3 weeks of that testing process, we offset over 36,000 kilograms of carbon dioxide, which was the equivalent of planting 2,000 trees. And that was before the system was even fully operational. Really kind of amazing. And then just one last thing I will share is over the next year, we'll be reconfiguring our solar training lab to integrate energy storage and electric vehicle charging technology into that curriculum. Because I think both of those technologies are going to be really interesting in how that plays into the entire market and going to have a big impact on the workforce.
Super. Thank you so much, Ken. So now we're going to dive into some of the big thorny issues and opportunities. So one we heard about today at our keynote was Xcel Energy. Madison Gas and Electric has similarly made a very aggressive plan to reduce carbon. And so let's talk a little bit about the utility scale and what the utilities need to do to scale up and meet an 80 to 100%, depending on your utility, carbon reduction by 2050, because that's going to take us, we're at about 12% renewables today according to our Renewable Portfolio Standard Report, and clearly we need to go far beyond that. So starting with Carrie Ann, tell us a little bit about your perspective and how the utilities are approaching this challenge to scale up.
Okay, thanks, Tyler. I would say, right out of the chute, I would say the first strategy we use and are employing is collaboration among our stakeholders. We have very many and varied stakeholders. We have our customers, many of whom are municipalities and governments, actually. We've, you know, led by a governor and chancellors and mayors and city councils and city committees and legislative bodies, and they all have various goals. And many of them in our service territory are setting aggressive carbon reduction and renewable energy goals, and we would very much like to help them achieve them. And so what we are working hard on is focusing on achieving our common energy goals and how can we help one another. We have those aggressive goals too. We cannot meet them without our customers and that collaboration. They can't meet theirs without us. And so One example is I'm leading a collaboration with the city of Madison. They have a very aggressive carbon reduction renewable energy goal, and so we're working together to identify ways that we can help each other achieve them. Mm-hmm. That's a strategy that we're using to meet what is both an obstacle and an opportunity, I think, is that all of these folks have different goals and different thoughts about how to achieve them. And sometimes we need to just focus, you know, try to focus on that which we can do together mm-hmm. now mm-hmm. to get as far as we can as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. So that's one way or one thing. I'd also say that we are in a very transformative time in the industry, of course. There's so much change. It's mind-numbing sometimes, the pace and the amount of change. And I think that one of the obstacles, but yet real opportunities we see, is that as people do still want electricity 24/7, there's a real opportunity, well, there's a need for the grid to be able to help as a tool in that. How do we take all of these varying and new technologies and help them work together to continue to provide that seamless service to people? So I look at it as sort of an orchestra, like mm-hmm. a dynamic orchestra, and there's a place for a conductor of that to really help all of these technologies to work together, utility scale, distributable level, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And Ken mentioned it, but the reliability and adaptability of the electric grid and the availability of transmission, I think, are really critical to being able to deploy all of these resources. So continuing to invest in those sorts of technologies is going to continue to be really important and a challenge. We've experienced, just like any others in this economy, workforce and supply challenges mm-hmm. during this construction boom. That will continue, I believe. And Ken, we're hoping you're solving all of those workforce problems for us. But that's just, you know, MG&E on the utility side of things is a small customer. So we can be impacted by the market for sure. Mm-hmm. Costs. We have got to manage costs for people. It is important that all people get to benefit from these technologies, not just those that can afford to access it. So we have to be able to, that again is an importance of the utility. We have a critical role to provide in that regard in providing clean energy for all people. Cybersecurity mm-hmm. is certainly a challenge and something that we are always working on. And then finally, I think we have an opportunity, but as well as a challenge in keeping our own technology internally up to date mm-hmm. so that we can provide the services that our customers want and deserve. So that's, I mean, it's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And we've had workforce challenges on that end too. I mean, you need IT professionals and people who are, you know, have very specialized experience and knowledge to be able to help deploy that kind of like system-wide upgrade that we at MG&E are going through right now.
Super. Now that's great. And Beth, from the utility scale kind of solar and wind developer perspective, what are you seeing as the challenges to be able to go from the phenomenal amount of wind and solar, mostly wind we've built so far, but now we need to do it 4 or 5 or 6 times as much to meet right. these goals?
Yeah, that's right. There are 3 or 4 things that really come to the top for me. And so the speed of how quickly we can actually scale up is a question, I mm-hmm. think. With all these other challenges. But when you look at, in the footprint that we work in across the MISO energy marketplace, we have roughly 18,000 megawatts of wind and about 300, but quickly growing, megawatts of solar. We need to double or 2.5 times per year what we're doing right now. And so we need to significantly speed up if we're gonna get a significant penetration level of renewable energy. So that's one thing. We need to go faster. The legacy resources are a barrier. Mm-hmm. And so we've talked and heard from speakers a little bit today. How do you pay off the real costs that are still outstanding? People are looking at securitization, different ways to do that. You know, does the fuel savings over the long term from wind and solar allow you to implement new and pay down existing over time? What kinds of combinations of things could be done? If you could wipe out everything we have today and do it differently, mm-hmm. I mean, that would be one thing. But as we transition everything over, that how you sequence all of that is a huge challenge. Who pays is another big one. How do we allocate the costs of both the legacy systems, the new systems? How do you apportion that among customer classes? Who pays for upgrades that to interconnect the new resources? That's a big challenge. And then the last one really for utility scale solar and wind right now is transmission. And I know it's not a popular topic. We've heard a little bit in our breakout panel on utility scale, kind of some comments on that. But if you ask the wind industry right now what the number one challenge is, it is lack of transmission capacity. And so we can't do large carbon reduction cost effectively without more transmission. Badger Cooley helped with that, but Cardinal Hickory Creek, there are at least 4,000 megawatts of wind and a little bit of solar that is counting on Cardinal Hickory Creek. And without that, you won't see projects come online, and those that are existing already are being curtailed, so we're not getting all of the energy from those projects. So that's a really critical piece for utility scale, cost-effective projects that a lot of utilities are purchasing and investing in today.
Great, and Amy, from the distributed perspective, how do you see distributed energy, distributed solar, helping to meet these big audacious goals that utilities and communities are setting?
We won't get there without the investment of the customers, without the rooftops that homeowners have, that our businesses have, that our schools have. And the way to do it is to allow customers to make that investment, to have the private marketplace create those financing solutions. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a one size fits all to how we do this, that we will, from the distributed generation side, be part of that mix, not only to create more reliability, to create more backup power, to create a more resilient grid, but also addressing those costs. And years ago, you used to think about, well, maybe down the line, we will start to see the benefits from allowing and investing in distributed generation on the grid, but we're seeing those results today. So we're seeing California, we're seeing projects for transmission lines or upgrades that don't happen because there are enough energy efficiency and distributed generation on the grid, they've been able to avoid projects. Every place is completely different. But that was just used as an example that this is happening today. There are real dollars and real values that can help us as we scale up to the 80%, the 100% clean energy goals, but we're not going to get it without those clear rules. And we've heard it throughout the day today. You've had lots of questions that on the cards of what does that financing look like? Sunrun, our business model is to make a big chunk of our business model is to make sure families, we increase access so more people do get to participate. If we're saying, well, right now we're only seeing certain customers, certain businesses like IKEA be able to invest in solar, the solution isn't to say, well, we can only do that. The solution is to allow more solutions so we have increased access, that customers can see the benefit of that on their energy bills and manage their energy bills. Sunrun, we bring a lot of the financing to the customers through equipment leases or PPAs, depending on the state. It's not just us that's looking for that solution. This is becoming a huge issue. I'd like to maybe ask the developers or installers, we're not taking names, but how many people have had customers that say, I want to do solar, but I'd love to finance it in a creative way, but then projects have stalled because you don't know what the rules of the road are here in Wisconsin? All right, so there are projects that can move forward with financing from the private market, but because there has not been action on this, those are the rules, mm-hmm. right? So the inaction that we're seeing, we heard about, we don't need to take action, everything's fine. We need some clarity there. We need to be able to know that third-party financing, if it is fine for large-scale developers, we can finance utility-scale projects, so can customers who want to manage their energy bills. I think that for us to be able to, if we're thinking about alternatives other than mandates and how we're going to get to these goals, we need to get everybody at the table and figure out how to get there.
Thank you. And Ken, yeah, we're depending on you for, you know, a few thousand jobs. So tell us,
yes,
what are the challenges of taking a workforce of today in Wisconsin, what we've got for renewables? All of our members that do rooftop solar are telling us we need good electricians, we need good project managers, we need good installers. And so they're having trouble. And now in pops 300, 150, you add up all these megawatts of large scale, we need people. How are we going to meet that challenge?
It's daunting. I can tell you, you know, we've had meetings with some of the developers of the large solar farms. We met with folks from Badger Hollow, and they're talking about 200 workers at the start of construction, ramping up to a peak workforce of between 400 and 500. We have 50 students in our program right now at Madison College, which means we're going to be drawing people not just from our school, but from lots of the other technical colleges in the state as well that have renewable energy programs, and there's pressure on all of us to try and scale up. It's a huge economic injection that's coming into the state, but it's also a lot of pressure on us as workforce providers. The hard thing for us is getting people into the pipeline. Mm-hmm. If you're a student aspiring to go into nursing or into automotive repair or into police science, those are pretty well-established career tracks. You probably have a family member or a friend who may be in that profession that serves as a role model. There's established pathways. There's established industry credentials. It's easy to find career advice. It's much harder if you want to go into renewable energy. The careers haven't been around as long. There aren't as many people doing it. And as a result, for our students to identify a program and plug in, we need help recruiting. Mm-hmm. So I would reach out to the audience and I would say, if you know somebody who is good with numbers, somebody who is good with math, somebody who is good with tools and likes to work outdoors, somebody who is good with computers and telecommunication, encourage them to pursue a career in clean energy, and we will be glad to welcome those students to our campus so that we can try and fill all these jobs that are coming online.
Oh, that's super. I wanted to note, if anybody does have questions for the panel, there will be an opportunity to take questions at the end, and I think we've got some volunteers that can collect those. Moving on to energy storage, there's a lot of excitement around energy storage. Clearly, the technology can hold a lot of promise, both at the distributed level, homes being able to be available if they're off-grid today or if the power goes out, businesses being able to cut demand charges at the utility scale, being able to manage wind and solar on the grid. So a lot of excitement, and I'm going to start with Amy to talk a little bit about Sunrun and how you guys view distributed storage. You guys have got into this market. Tell us about that and what the future can hold.
Yeah, so Sunrun has, in six of our states now, six or seven, we offer a solar plus storage product. And it serves different purposes in different states. And for those of you who are curious, it's called Brightbox. We use the LG Chem battery as part of our system. And we think about it from a long-term perspective. It's not meant to serve just one goal as backup power if your grid goes down. That will always be a benefit to that customer, and that will always be reserved. But how do we sit down with utilities and say, let's not just keep that. How do we provide these other benefits to the grid, to other ratepayers? And so we think about it as, you know, your residential customer gets to see bill savings. You can do, you know, you can use batteries to manage peak times. So if there are time of use rates, if there are those times when the utilities demand, you need more power, well, we can have a contract through all of our aggregated systems with the utility to provide that power at different times. It's something that homeowner, this is how we're approaching it. Other people are, you know, taking different paths, but the homeowner then doesn't have to think about that. We provide that service for the customer. That's sort of how we use a good chunk of our storage system in California. The other piece are just the other benefits that go along with having behind-the-meter storage. things like frequency, things like backup. So not only can that customer have backup power, but if the grid goes down on a certain distribution, on a certain node, the utility can also access part of that storage as well. And so it's making sure that as we are developing different ideas, and really we're kind of down in the thick of it in Puerto Rico working with PREPA and working with the folks who are rebuilding that infrastructure from scratch, what are the services that a utility would need? What are those benefits? And so we work to keep our customers online, connected to the grid, to be able to bring all those benefits to other ratepayers. The piece of that is making sure that there is the fair valuation of what those benefits are. So right now we have, you know, all the states that we work in, we have the net metering, a net metering scheme to fairly compensate up to a certain point, right, as solar is coming online. When you start adding in other benefits of storage, let's make sure that there's that fair compensation and the utilities can be made whole for utilizing that as well. So making that transition from a centralized system to not only decentralized but democratized, and making sure we're using all of that. So that's just our simple concept of how we're approaching how the storage can help shape the grid of the future.
Great. I'm going to move down to Ken, because in our prep call, Ken mentioned that he got his PhD 20 years ago studying lithium ion batteries. So tell us about that and where lithium ion has come since then, and what that means as you're training students and what you think the future can hold for battery storage.
So I was actually reflecting on this as I was driving over this morning. I was working on lithium ion batteries at that time with Rayovac, a local Madison company, and Argonne National Lab. And I can recall at one point during my degree, we were working on batteries about the size of a watch battery now. We calculated out the cost of that material, and that material worked out being a little bit more expensive than the price of gold at the time. Those batteries are now in cars, right? So what was a watch battery is now a large several kilowatt hour pack powering vehicles at a cost that's affordable to a consumer. It's been an amazing technological advance since the time I was in graduate school. What's exciting about that is any of the material science and chemical technology breakthroughs that are happening in the transportation sector ultimately translate back to stationary energy storage as well, because it's the same material just packaged in a larger format and outfitted with a different set of controls. So I think those two market segments are going to develop in tandem as we go forward. And if you look at the cost trajectory of solar, you see the same thing happening in energy storage, which is lagging by about a decade, but gaining ground really quickly. I think the exciting thing to see develop is, you know, as that happens, energy storage makes renewable energy better, right? Mm-hmm. Everything that you like about renewables becomes more awesome when it's dispatchable, right? Becomes even cooler when you can integrate both solar technology and electric vehicle technology, when you can drive on sunshine and eliminate tailpipe emissions. Mm-hmm. That's a dream come true for everyone. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody that buys a car that really wants to purchase a bunch of exhaust, right? That's not what we're looking for as consumers.
Right.
So I think the other key technology that's enabling that piece is SCADA systems, control and data management systems. Because in order to achieve maximum benefit from energy storage, those systems need to be talking to your solar system constantly, need to be talking to the grid constantly, need to decide when do I charge, when do I discharge. Ideally, you'd want to know what are the time of use rates that are there, but also what are the weather forecasts. If you think out far enough, if we could have real-time energy pricing, you could have demand response built into those systems. Now, that's way more sophisticated than the solar string inverter with a little liquid crystal display that we had 10 years ago. So again, if you know any students who are good with numbers and good with computer science, send them to our school. We're actually working to build some of that technology into our program as we speak.
Great. And Beth, how is energy storage playing out at the large scale? And your organization, like you said, sort of broadened its umbrella to incorporate it. So clearly there's an opportunity.
Yes. So we are working particularly at the wholesale level in the MISO footprint. FERC issued Order 841 around storage. And so organized power markets have to change their tariffs to allow storage to provide the services and be compensated that it can provide. So that's launched a large conversation about, again, how do you reformulate kind of the rules of the road to allow this new technology to provide value to the marketplace. And it's a very complicated discussion, but lots of potential there for benefits to customers at all levels. And Tyler, if you'll just flip to my slide, I just wanted to make sure I borrowed this from Xcel Energy, but it really shows that you can have energy storage at, you know, all levels on the grid. It's got lots of different services and value it can provide. It's really about the rules that are go around storage. What does the grid need? What do we need as part of the larger overall portfolio? What's going to provide value to customers long term? And as we move to decarbonize our grid, what role is storage going to play? I just wanted to have people think a minute about the storage that we have in the grid already today. So utilities have gone to sharing reserves with other with their neighbors, and so they each didn't have to build a big new power plant. So they share those reserves. That's stored energy that you can share back and forth. We've got the grid that has grown up over time, that where you can send electrons back and forth in time and space, depending on where the energy is needed. So we already have a form of storage in our electricity system today. So we're doing kind of storage 2.0 on with some of these new things. For our utility scale folks that we work with, they're looking really hard at how do they add storage to existing projects. So hybrid projects are what they're called. Maybe you can take a wind or solar farm and add storage and provide a different value. The thing that's going to make everything work is the communication system that has to be built to enable, whether it's customers, behind the meter, utilities, commercial and industrial customers, whoever it is, this has to happen seamlessly, because I don't think any of us want to become energy traders. You know, we want our houses to do it automatically, and we want the utilities to be able to tap into our resources when they need to shave peak, or when they need to ramp up resources because some outage has happened somewhere, or somebody needs more power. And so the communications platform that we're going to need to build is pretty complex, and that's part of the big transition that has to happen. So there's a lot of flexibility that storage can provide, but it's going to be coupled with these other types of resources. And then I would just say finally that Amy's right. Every part of the country is different. We all have a different grid and generation portfolio that has grown up over time. And so we kind of take where we're at, and then we build on that. For the Midwest, we have such good wind and solar resources that other areas of the country may want our product. And so how do we deliver that valuable commodity, just like corn or beans or cheese or milk, to another part of the country that may want our product?
Great. And Carrie Ann, how does a utility, how are you looking at energy storage? Is it here? Is it the future?
I would both.
Yes.
I would say I think Amy used this, and I have it written down here too, that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to meeting these goals. We need all of them. Mm-hmm. We need all of us here in order to meet these renewable energy goals, all shapes and sizes and technologies, and we need a healthy grid and transmission network in order to deliver that. Right now, on the utility scale, we don't have the battery technology to make wind and solar dispatchable, to turn it on and off when we need it. It may very well come, and it may very well come, I just don't know exactly when, and that can cause challenges. I mean, that doesn't mean it's coming. It is. So I think that we look at it as a tool amongst the rest of our tools that will play an integral role in balancing the use of the grid, making it a more balancing load, making it a more efficient system, and offering all of the tools that Amy provided in terms of backup storage and the like. And again, it's all going to have to work together, but it's coming.
Great. Well, we're a little short on time, and so we had a question about electric vehicles, but I'm going to skip it because there's a much more exciting question from the audience. So we'll start with Ken and work our way back to Beth, okay?
Get the one I want.
So imagine a best case scenario in your view for clean renewables by 2030. And I think each of us may have slightly different metrics for this, but in your case, in your view, from your metrics, best case scenario by 2030, what does that look like from your perspective for clean renewable energy?
Well, speaking from an educational perspective, first of all, I can say there's 16 technical colleges in the state, four of which have renewable energy programs. It would be nice to see all of those technical colleges be able to foster a renewable energy program to meet this workforce challenge. Now, in order for the schools to make that investment, they need to have some assurance that once they go out and they build the laboratories, they hire the instructors, that the jobs are still going to be there 3 years later when they start graduating students, which means you need to have a stable policy, a long-range policy that supports the industry for the next 5 to 10 years. And when that happens, technical colleges can respond really quickly when they know that that's the direction that society has collectively decided to move. So that's what I'd like to see.
Great. Amy, maybe it's the number of homes with rooftop solar, or I don't know what your metric
all
is by 2030.
Is the answer all of them? All of them.
It can be the answer.
quite honestly, that was kind of flippant, but it's right? Let's use the resources that we have. But I think what that looks like is a mix of utility scale. We can argue over what the pieces are. Utility scale, community solar that results in real bill savings and manageability for customers, and rooftop solar for CNI customers, for our schools, our nonprofits, and homeowners. I think that will make sure not only can we have stable bills, do we have a reliable grid, we have a great workforce. That won't happen with just a pilot of a 35 megawatt pilot, right? It will take all of this coming to the head. And I think the other piece of it is in Illinois, we've kind of had this huge, it's been a lot of years to get to some legislation that's resulting in a lot of development, a lot of hiring of the workforce and a lot of training of that workforce. Some of our best conversations that we've had with ComEd, which is the poles and wires utility in the Chicagoland area, about where is this going? What are we going to do with smart inverters and storage? And what does that communication need to look like? The best conversations we've had is when the attorneys in the room, when I step back, when the other attorneys step back, and the engineers start talking to each other, and really thinking about, their brains are just going like crazy, what could this look like? We can only step back and make room for that conversation if we're not distracted with other little battles and unnecessary issues during this early, when we're early on in the transition. So I like to kind of make sure that we're still thinking forward of how do we get to those goals instead of being, and having uniform interconnection rules, allowing for storage to come online, allowing some uniform permitting. That's where how we're going to get there.
Yeah, Carrie Ann, from your perspective at MG&E, aggressively looking at 2030, and I know you're thinking about electric vehicles and some of these other carbon reduction opportunities to help the communities. So I don't know if it's a resource mix or a number of communities you've helped, or what do you think is the most exciting and aggressive metric you can envision in 12 years?
In terms of a metric, I don't know if I know the answer to that, but I would say that if I could be, queen for a little bit, I mean, by 2030, I really believe that one of our biggest and best efforts to reduce carbon emissions and simultaneously help us clean the grid is the electrification of everything. I really do. And I think that electrification of transportation is such a huge opportunity. The transportation sector not only now surpasses the electric sector in the production of carbon emissions, but is rising. Mm-hmm. And while our industry is working very hard to reduce our footprint, that is not happening yet in the transportation mm-hmm. sector. Mm-hmm. It's such a huge opportunity, I think, for us to reduce our carbon footprint, but then also that helps clean the grid mm-hmm. because having levelized or stable demand is very good for us in terms of being able to retire legacy assets mm-hmm. and build new renewable ones. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. to me, it's not a metric, Tyler, but it's
every car is electric in Madison.
It's every car is electric.
That's a good metric.
And the entire Madison Metro fleet,
okay,
too,
wonderful.
So, of buses. So
super, thank you. Mm-hmm. Beth, from your perspective.
Quickly, I would say one of the easiest ways is to look at number of megawatts that are deployed. Kilowatts add up to megawatts, and what's the number? Mm-hmm. It's got to be a big number.
Yeah.
If we need to double or 2.5 times what we're doing
each year, for every year,
yeah,
through 2030.
but I would also say it's that we've done the planning to really know what the roadmap is. Mm-hmm. Because if we just scramble and say, well, we're going to leave everything to mm-hmm. 2028, that's
right.
too late. Mm-hmm. So we need to do the planning, and everybody might not agree that it's going to turn out exactly that way, but we've let the engineers, do their thing, and we've given them some parameters of what does this look like. We will have figured out how to pay for some things. And to make that transition long-term and sustainable. And then I think finally, I think one of the biggest challenges to electrification is charging infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so when mm-hmm. we think of how difficult it's been to do transmission lines, where do we put charging infrastructure? And if that's gotta go in corridors and we've gotta pay for it, how do we do all of that? Mm-hmm. And so you can't electrify everything and have people buy EVs if they can't charge them up mm-hmm. and they don't have to be able to go from their homes to where they need to go. And so infrastructure to me has double and triple meanings.
Yeah.
We gotta build this stuff.
Tyler, can I just add an extra thought?
Yep.
So we mentioned the big solar system at that college, and we did that from both an environmental standpoint and an educational standpoint, but it also was an enormous economic opportunity for the college. The internal rate of return on that system is over 10%. You can't get that at a bank anywhere on any investment today. So it's returning a lot of value to our taxpayers. And if you ask me, what's my vision for the state, I think every public school district should have solar on the roof of their buildings. Well, I mentioned we created a solar roadmap at our school, prioritizing all of our systems. We want to share that plan with other schools. So if you know anybody on school boards in your home communities, I'd encourage you to have them reach out to our school. We'll have them meet with our CFO to run the numbers. We'll have them meet with our facilities manager and our building architects so that they can talk to each other's languages and find out about the technology. Because we'd like to see other people be able to do this and hopefully, dampen that learning curve for them, make it a little bit easier so that we can get everybody, every community, and every educational institution in the state to benefit similar effects as we have.
Well, and maybe some of those cost savings have to be used to construct infrastructure that we need to electrify our economy we have to find savings somewhere that's going to go towards paying for something else.
Yeah. You can see we have our work cut out for us, but we also have wonderful and talented and hardworking people helping make this transition and scaling up possible. So please thank this panel for me. And that was also a final segue into thanking the Renew Wisconsin staff for putting on a wonderful event and making everything go smoothly. Especially to Jody Jean Amble, who's our Communications and Events Director. She's over there. And is Lauren in the room? To Lauren Wiese, our Administrative Coordinator, who handled a lot of the day-to-day details of registrations and sponsorships. And clearly, none of this is possible without the support of a great team. I want to finally Once again, plug that right after this, right through those doors or around the corner, we're going to have a reception sponsored by our four Summit Leader sponsors, Arch Electric, EDP Renewables, EDF Renewables, and Invenergy. A couple of those companies are going to make some short remarks. And the final thing is the raffle for the Sunjack drawing. And I need to pick a raffle card. Oh, we're going to do the raffle out there, so you really have to stay and have a beer. Okay. Well, thank you all so much for coming. I hope you had a wonderful day. We're going to continue the conversation out there. Leave your feedback forms in our evaluation so we can keep improving. And once again, thank this panel and all the speakers today. Thank you so much.